Hi there. Welcome to the Cato Forum today on infrastructure. I'm Chris Edwards, an economist at the Cato Institute. I've written much over the years on the nation's infrastructure, such as highways and airports. But most of what I've learned has I've learned from our two panelists today, Bob Poole of the Reason Foundation and Randall O'Toole of the Cato Institute. I'm going to give a brief overview of what's in President Biden's infrastructure plan. And then we're going to hear from Bob and Randall. You can send us text questions that we will address after our panelists have spoken. There should be a text box on your screen. You can also tweet questions to us with the hashtag CatoEcon. Infrastructure is a hot issue. The President Biden has proposed a $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan, and Congress is considering various options over the next few weeks and months. We can break the nation's infrastructure into three different piles. The first pile is federal infrastructure, such as Amtrak, for example. The second pile is state and local infrastructure, such as highways and schools and transit systems. The third pile is private infrastructure, everything from broadband to electric utilities to freight railroads. There is no precise definition of infrastructure, but about 65% of the nation's infrastructure is owned by the private sector, about 30% is owned by state and local governments, and just 5% is owned by the federal government. President Biden's plan would increase subsidies for all three types of infrastructure. For example, he would increase federal subsidies for Amtrak by $80 billion. He would increase subsidies for state and local infrastructure, such as $115 billion for highways, $100 billion for schools, $66 billion for water systems, and $25 billion more for airports. Biden is also proposing huge subsidies for private sector infrastructure, which is really unprecedented and not in a good way. Biden would subsidize manufacturing by $300 billion, electric vehicles by $170 billion, broadband, $100 billion, and electric power, $100 billion. And like all federal subsidies, this new aid would be tied to top-down federal regulations. As one example, Biden makes clear that he wants labor union regulations tied to all this new federal spending. The infrastructure debate has many different parts. Politicians often focus on spending, but a more important question is, who owns infrastructure? Who should fund it, and who would best manage infrastructure, the federal government, state and local governments, or the private sector? Can government infrastructure be moved to the private sector? How do we tackle congestion on highways and other infrastructure? And why is some infrastructure in such bad shape, such as the subway systems in DC and New York City? To tackle these questions, Bob and Randall will each talk for about 12 minutes. And then I'll wrap up with 5 to 10 minutes of comments. And then we will go to questions that, again, you can type into the text box on your screen there, or you can send us through Twitter. So first up will be Bob Poole, who's Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation. Bob is one of the nation's most prolific writers on transportation over many years. He's an expert on highways and airports and air traffic control systems. I'd highly recommend his 2018 book, Rethinking America's Highways. Bob's got degrees in mechanical engineering, but to his credit, he thinks like an economist on infrastructure issues, which is a good thing. Randall O'Toole is a Cato Senior Fellow specializing in transportation, land use, and environmental issues. He's written 6 books, most recently, Romance of the Rails, Why the Passenger Trains We Love Are Not the Transportation We Need. Randall loves railroads, but he finds compelling evidence that government subsidies for rail, whether it's Amtrak or subways or light rail, is really very unproductive and not efficient. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Bob Poole to take it away.
There we go. Thanks very much. I'm sorry for the delay in getting started. I think the overall philosophy that underlies the Biden plan is troubling from the transportation part of it. It ignores the user pay, user benefit principle, which is the foundation of what we call the user taxes that originated with Oregon in 1919 and are a very wise principle. It ignores the role of potential private capital to leverage whatever money federal government would invest and state governments for that matter. And it also ignores sound principles of federalism in terms of which level of government should do which function. On highways, the $115 billion over 8 years sounds like a lot, but the way it appears to be divided up is kind of disappointing. It ignores the need to spend an estimate of $1 trillion over 20 years to rebuild the interstate highway system. And there's no mention of the interstates, which is the most important infrastructure in surface transportation. And a hugely disproportionate increase in transit funding compared to roads and bridges, even though transit, as Randall will tell you, handles a tiny fraction of the passenger miles of travel in the country. So the $115 billion, first of all, $50 billion is supposed to be for 20,000 miles, including local streets and state highways to bring them to better repair. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually not going to go very far in terms of the, particularly if you look at the cost of reconstructing and modernizing the interstates. $40 billion is for 10,000 out of about 45,000 structurally deficient bridges in the United States. That's also not going to go very far. There's no mention at all of benefit cost assessment, of making sure that whatever money does get spent is on projects that will be worth, where the benefits are greater than the cost. The $20 billion for road safety raises a big question mark. This could be largely to fund things like the so-called complete streets projects that take away lanes and lower speed limits in order to make more space for pedestrians and bicyclists and less space for cars. And the Reconnecting Neighborhoods program, I very much fear this could mean tearing down urban interstates that were originally not imposed by the federal government or by the state DOTs, but by big city mayors that insisted that they wanted this federal money right inside their city limits, not limited to interstates between states. Urban Transit, Randall will speak much more. We weren't sure he was going to be able to get online for this, but $55 billion is for the deferred maintenance, which if they're going to spend money, that's probably the least bad place to spend it. But $25 billion is for transit expansion, and this contradicts the fix-it-first philosophy of the whole proposal and the very uncertain demand for transit following the recovery from the COVID pandemic. And that it also basically assumes without evidence that transit will have a lower carbon footprint in the next few decades than personal vehicles. Airports expose a proposed $25 billion expansion of the existing AIP Airport Improvement Program, which historically has only been available to spend on airside projects. For the first time, some of it could be used to expand terminals, which would be potentially good for competition. But it ignores altogether the self-help passenger facility charge, which is a local charge Congress allows airports to levy, which can be bonded against to finance terminal expansions. But the cap on it has not been changed since, I think, 1990. And almost all the money that's there is already committed to existing long-term bonds. So there's a big need for more of that. And that is apparently not mentioned. Rural broadband. Chris asked me, it's not transportation, but asked me to comment briefly on this one. $100 billion for high-speed broadband, mainly for rural areas. Now, this ignores that the FCC has a large program that is been moving forward for years with competitive auctions open to all broadband technologies, whereas the Biden plan would fund only local agencies and co-ops, and apparently is limited to fiber optics, which is a very costly way to do low-density rural areas. So my suggestion of alternative principles would be to, first of all, reinforce rather than destroy the users pay, users benefit principle, which is very sound. And there's all kinds of academic literature as well as practical experience that's showing this gets the incentives right to make sure that the users who are paying the fees are the ones ultimately who benefit. A second principle would be to tap into the hundreds of billions of dollars of private capital that is sitting in public pension funds and infrastructure investment funds, looking for good opportunities to invest in revenue-generating long-term infrastructure, including transportation. And finally, if there's going to be federal funding, it should focus on major projects with multi-state impacts, not on local functions that are proper responsibilities of state and local governments, in my view. On highways, the major focus should be rebuilding the most important of the highways, the interstate highway system. The TRB study that I mentioned estimated this would cost $1 trillion over the next 20 years. In almost all states, this could be financed with toll revenues, but toll revenues are currently illegal for the 95% of the interstates that weren't developed originally with tolls. But these projects, if that tolling were allowed, would be a good fit for long-term public-private partnership, P3 projects that pension funds and infrastructure funds would love to invest in. And it would be lower risk than brand new highways, because these are existing highways with known traffic histories. Another point is that if we're going to get tolling, the federal ban on tolling needs to be rethought. And there's an existing three-state pilot program that should be offered to all states to rebuild all of their interstates using toll finance if they choose to do so, but requiring them to use customer-friendly tolling policies so that they do not turn this into a general cash cow for the state government. And the private activity bonds that allow P3s to compete on a level cost of bonds with public agencies has all been used up. The $15 billion Congress authorized needs to be at least doubles. It probably would be better to remove the cap altogether. And if this kind of program started using self-help toll finance by the states, it would gradually reduce demands on the Highway Trust Fund as states take that burden, at least some of it, away from the feds. A short-term fix that I proposed to the EPW committee in testimony a week or two ago would be to dedicate all the highway user tax revenues to highway spending, which was the original promise of the Highway Trust. That's why it's called the Highway Trust Fund. Fund transit and non-highway programs, however much Congress wants to, from the general fund, where that has to compete with other general fund programs. And I believe that highway users would be more likely to support modest increase in highway user taxes if they became pure user taxes again. And the money that's coming in from highway users is almost the amount that's actually spent by the feds on highways. It's all the other stuff that is causing the fund to be in such dire straits. Finally, federal government has a role to play in continuing to support the research and pilot projects to, we're eventually going to have to replace per gallon fuel taxes with per mile charges. So we need more multi-state, regional, and truck pilot projects to on these mileage-based user fees. They're called road user charges in the West. And federal research on the institutions that will be needed to collect and enforce federal and state mileage fees, such as state DMVs and the International Fuel Tax Agreement that already exists to divvy up truck fuel taxes among states, regardless of where they buy the fuel. For airports, the cap on airport PFCs, which I said is basically almost all being used already for existing bonds, should be doubled at least and indexed to inflation. Private activity bonds should be expanded to airports, including for renovation of existing facilities and long-term leases. And not infrastructure per se, but airports should be allowed to select their own certified screening companies, with TSA not being the heavy hand that imposes a company on an airport that wants to have this. And if we're dreaming dreams of reform, the airport slot system, which is political and arbitrary and protects incumbents, should be replaced with runway pricing of landings and takeoffs. And so that's what I would propose if I were asked. Urban transit, Randall will have more to say, but there should no longer be, at least for the next 5 years, capital grants to expand rail systems, given the focus of the need for fixing it first. And if there's going to be operating support from the federal government, it should be only to subsidize the fare of low-income riders, and reasonable fees to recover operating costs should be levied on affluent riders, who are increasingly the ones who ride rail transit. Finally, on broadband, don't subsidize fiber for low-density rural areas and rely on the FCC's program, which includes satellite broadband providers, which will probably turn out to be the most cost-effective way to reach rural people in low-density areas. And I look forward to the questions when we get done.
I think Randall's having trouble with his internet connection there, interestingly enough. So why don't I give a few more comments, and then we'll go back to Randall to see if his internet connection is working better. So thanks for those comments, Bob. So my overall view of the Biden plan is that we simply don't need it. Biden's two main pots of money are for state infrastructure and private infrastructure. That first pot of money for state infrastructure is not needed because the states can raise their own taxes and user charges for infrastructure like highways anytime they want. And indeed, half of the states have raised their own gas taxes in just the last 5 years. So there's really no federal action required there. States can raise their own money. The second pot of money that Biden is promising is for private infrastructure. So, for example, President Biden wants to spend $174 billion in subsidies for electric vehicles. But there's really already huge private investment in electric vehicles. General Motors announced recently that they will invest $27 billion in electric vehicles just over the next 5 years. And electric vehicle charging stations are going in across the nation. Biden wants to subsidize charging stations for electric vehicles, but there's already about 40,000 electric vehicle charging stations in the nation. You may have noticed at your local Target or Walmart, they've got whole lines of EV charging stations these days. So, you know, the private sector is doing it here. We don't need more subsidies for EVs. The political irony here is that leading Democrats, including Biden, often lambaste corporate subsidies. But Biden's own infrastructure plan is really a huge and massive handouts of corporate subsidies, which are unneeded. The other contradiction in Biden's plan is that while he would be handing out these corporate subsidies, he would fund the corporate subsidies with a $2 trillion corporate tax increase. Biden says his plan will make America more competitive and able to compete with China, but his big corporate tax increase would do the opposite. The Tax Foundation, a think tank in Washington, found that Biden's corporate tax increase would reduce private investment by $1 trillion. That means less private investment in infrastructure, such as broadband and electric utilities. And that's the opposite of what President Biden says he wants. So consider broadband, which Bob talked about. Companies such as AT&T are already investing $50 billion or more a year in broadband. So the internet is getting better all the time, and that's a good thing. But President Biden's corporate tax hike will reduce investment in broadband companies, so for example. So Biden's plan would make us less competitive with other countries, and that's the opposite of what President Biden wants to do. Another contradiction of Biden's plan is that it is billed as a green plan, a way to tackle climate change. But the green way to fund infrastructure such as highways and water systems is by user charges, because user charges limit consumer demand. If local water systems need upgrades, for example, water authorities should increase user charges to raise the money for that investment. And that would have the benefit of limiting water usage. But Biden's plan would use subsidies and not user charges. So Biden's infrastructure funding plan is not green at all. So what's my alternative to the Biden plan? How do we ensure that we have efficient investment and good management of infrastructure? Well, the answer, I think, is decentralization. Where we can, we should move infrastructure to the private sector, where it can be funded by user charges, as Bob was talking about. A good example is airports. All of America's major airports are owned by state and local governments, but there's really no reason for that. About half of Europe's major airports are owned by the private sector, and they're generally self-funded by user charges and retail concessions and advertising and other commercial revenues. Biden's plan would increase airport subsidies. Biden's plan says, quote, according to some rankings, no U.S. airports rank in the top 25 of airports worldwide, unquote. But that's because all U.S. airports are owned by governments, whereas many abroad have been privatized, such as London's Heathrow. So there's no need to subsidize airports from the federal level. The same is true, by the way, of seaports. Seaports should be self-funded by user charges. Currently, many U.S. seaports need upgrades to handle larger container ships, and they lobby Washington for money, and they often wait years to get it, which delays needed seaport improvements. But that makes no sense, because seaports can raise their own money from user charges to fund their own expansion. They don't need to wait for Washington for subsidies. Other countries have privatized their airports and their postal systems, their passenger rail systems, their air traffic control systems. Hong Kong privatized its subway system. The Canadians privatized their air traffic control system. These reforms have worked. So my recommendation is that Congress should study these foreign reforms and adopt the best practices here in the United States. To touch on something Bob said, the federal government imposes limits on the states being able to fund their own infrastructure. Bob mentioned with airports, the federal government puts a limit on how much states can raise from passenger charges to fund their own airports. That makes no sense. Similarly with highways, which are owned by state governments, including the entire interstate system, the federal government limits the electronic tolling of interstate highways. That makes no sense. Those limits should be repealed so that states can fully fund their own infrastructure. So in sum, I would say that, you know, Biden's infrastructure plan is a bad solution looking for a problem. The private sector is already investing billions of dollars in infrastructure favored by Biden, such as electric vehicles and broadband. Many states have raised their own gas taxes and vehicle fees in recent years to fund their own highways, and that's fine. That makes more sense than federal funding. So the nation does not need a new spending package from Washington on infrastructure, especially when it's coupled with an infrastructure-killing corporate tax increase. So those are my comments. And now we're going to see if we can go back to Randall to see if his internet connection is working a little better. Are you there, Randall?
I'm here. I hope it's working a little better.
Let's
see if I can resume the show. I wanted to point out that the average American traveled about 16,000 miles by automobile in 2019, 2,300 miles by air, 164 miles by transit, and 19 miles by Amtrak. Transit and Amtrak together were less than 1% of all passenger travel and 0% of freight. And yet the Biden plan would put more than half of the transportation dollars into transit and Amtrak. That's a plan based on fantasy. The Republican plan that was issued last week is a little better, but still puts way too much money for transit and probably too much money for Amtrak. Now, people say we haven't been spending enough money on transit and Amtrak. But the reality is, since 1970, we've spent well over $1.6 trillion in today's money on transit, and transit ridership has dropped from about 50 trips per urban resident per year in 1970 to about 37 in 2019. Amtrak, we've put nearly $100 billion into, and Amtrak ridership has been, at best, stagnant, and if not declining. The pandemic has made these trends worse. Amtrak and transit are running at about 25 to 30% of historic ridership, whereas driving is at about 90%. And I don't think anybody expects Amtrak and transit to fully recover after the pandemic to their 2019 levels. Now, the subsidies we've given to Amtrak and transit have not just been inadequate. In fact, I would argue that there are too much subsidies. The subsidies have shielded Amtrak and transit from the need to be efficient. They can rely on subsidies to pay for half of Amtrak costs and almost 80% of transit costs, So they don't need to be efficient, and so they waste a lot of money. Subsidies shield them from the need to be innovative. When new innovators like Uber and Lyft come along, their solution is to tax the innovators and use the money for transit. And in fact, innovation in the transit industry basically comes out down to figuring out who we can tax in addition to who we're already taxing. Subsidies aren't helping low-income people. Less than 5% of low-income people rely on transit to get to work. The most common income class riding transit is people who earn over $75,000 a year. And yet the subsidies to transit are mostly out of regressive taxes. And so low-income people are disproportionately paying high taxes to subsidize rides taken disproportionately by high-income people. The reason why low-income people aren't riding transit is because transit doesn't give people access to jobs. Studies by the University of Minnesota have found that in the largest urban areas, you can reach more jobs in 20 minutes by car than you can reach by transit in 60 minutes. And in fact, you can reach more jobs in trips of 50 minutes or less on a bicycle than you can by urban transit. So transit just is a total failure at getting people to work. Transit is also not energy efficient or environmentally friendly. Since 2009, transit has been less energy efficient than the average car on the road. Since 2017, it's been less energy efficient than the average light truck on the road. Amtrak responded to President Biden's proposal by publishing this map that lists all the new lines that it wants to run trains to, including trains to Cheyenne, Wyoming, Duluth, Minnesota, Rockland, Maine, and other small towns. Now, these are very nice towns to live in, perhaps, but they aren't, they don't have the population needed to support a passenger train. And so this is going to be completely wasted. One of the cities on the map is Las Vegas, the fourth largest tourist destination in the country. They want to run a train from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, but Amtrak will be facing enormous competition. Right now, there are about 45 buses a day between Las Vegas and Los Angeles. They take about a little over 5 hours, and the fares start at $20. Airlines run more than 50 flights a day, and this is during the pandemic. It was even more before the pandemic. They take a little over an hour, and again, fares start at $20. Amtrak, when they last ran trains to Las Vegas, there was one train a day. It took almost 7 hours. And currently the fare from Oakland to Reno is $43. Los Angeles to Las Vegas is 100 miles more, so the fare is probably going to be larger. It comes down to, on trips of less than 200 miles, Amtrak simply cannot compete against the economy and flexibility of buses. On trips of more than 200 miles, Amtrak simply cannot compete against the economy and speed of planes. Amtrak does go through some nice territory, but the seats are uncomfortable. The sleeping accommodations are cramped and overpriced. The food is lousy. And the reason why Amtrak can get away with this is because Amtrak's real constituents are not its riders. They're the people who vote to give Amtrak subsidies. And so Amtrak runs trains in 46 states in order to get political support from politicians in all of those states. Its proposal under the Biden plan would expand that to at least one more state. As Bob said, we really need to return to a user fee system, funding transit out of fares, funding Amtrak out of ticket revenues. And for highways, I really like mileage-based user fees. Oregon has a mileage-based user fee program, and I'm a participant in that program. If anybody has any questions about that program, I'd be glad to talk with them after the show, or if you have questions, we can maybe handle them during the show. The real advantages of user fees are that it makes transportation providers responsive to the users and not to politicians. It also makes sure that transportation facilities are in good condition. For example, only about 2% of bridges that are funded by tolls are in poor condition. About 5% of bridges that are funded by gas taxes are in poor condition. Almost 12% of bridges that are funded out of general funds are in poor condition. Funding out of user fees will also keep transportation agencies from planning trains or bridges to nowhere. And it's socially just because you pay for what you use, you don't pay for what somebody else uses. So for all these reasons, we need to return to user fees. The problem with both the Biden and the Republican plan is that they don't say where the money is going to come from. It should come from user fees, and then we'll solve a lot of our transportation and infrastructure problems. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Randall. We've had some questions coming in, so I'm going to take a few of those questions, a few myself, and then we'll hand some to Randall and Bob. One question coming in asked about the issue of do state governments delay projects waiting for federal money? I indicated that there is a pattern of seaports delaying projects while they wait for federal money, which I think is really inefficient. I've just noticed in news stories over the years that seaports such as in Charleston, they need to expand, they need to dredge the seaport to be ready for the bigger container ships coming in now. And rather than just going ahead and raising their own charges and expanding their own facilities, they get their members of Congress and senators to lobby Congress for expansion. And sometimes this can literally take many years. So I just think it's really inefficient relying on the political process in Washington to fund infrastructure when state and local governments can, you know, have the ability to raise money themselves for their own infrastructure. Then another question coming in, and I'll hand this over to Bob, is there's a question about, I think we both complained about the fact that the states don't have the full authority to impose electronic tolling on their interstates, which state governments own. And the question was sort of, what is the origin of that? Why does the federal government have that cap on tolling of the interstates?
Well, one of the original plans for the interstate system in the early 50s was a toll system inspired by the Pennsylvania Turnpike and the other emerging turnpikes and throughways, New York Thruway and so forth. But it turned out at the time there were two problems. One, much of the South did not have the population that would make enough traffic to support toll revenues. And that was true of some of the Mountain West also. And second problem was there was a very powerful senator, I think from West Virginia, who was adamantly opposed to tolls. And he had a lot of clout in terms of the system, of the politics. So early interstate plans were voted down in Congress. When they finally came up with the idea of dedicated gasoline taxes in a highway trust fund with the ability to send out somewhat more money to the states where the costs of building were higher and so forth, that proved to be the secret sauce that got the deal done. Plus the promise of the last minute in the last 6 months, basically recruiting urban mayors who got the prospect of, oh my gosh, we can get all this highway capacity at 5%, we only have to come up with 5% and the feds will pay 95%, cut us in. And so that switched a lot of urban senators and representatives to support the gas tax program. And so the provision was that if you build an interstate using the 95% federal funding, you shall not put tolls on it ever. And that's still the law today, apart from a few exceptions Congress has carved out in the last 20 years.
Okay, thanks, Bob. And maybe the next question will go to Randall. One of the incoming questions, I think Bob mentioned that, you know, he would favor removing transit from the Highway Trust Fund. Currently, the Highway Trust Fund, that the money mainly comes from gasoline taxes. It's split between highways and mass transit systems in cities. And Randall, the question is, so if you remove transit funding from the Highway Trust Fund, wouldn't that be contrary to climate change goals?
Goals, because transit doesn't save greenhouse gases. Transit in 2019 emitted almost exactly the same amount of greenhouse gases per passenger mile as automobiles. And in fact, about 40% of transit ridership is in New York City, and since they're electric-powered transit, gets its power from nuclear power and other non-fossil fuel sources. In New York City, transit does save greenhouse gases, but in almost every other city, transit emits far more greenhouse gases than driving a car or even an SUV. In fact, you could be driving around in a Chevy Suburban all by yourself and emitting fewer greenhouse gases per mile than transit emits in most cities in the country. So the idea that transit is good for climate change is just an idea that's perpetrated by the industry, but it turns out it's not true.
Thanks, Randall. Now a question for Bob. Bob, you raised the issue of the in broadband funding, the difference between Biden's proposed broadband funding for rural areas and the current funding provided by the FCC. Can you go into a little more detail in describing the current FCC funding for broadband and why we don't need the new Biden funding?
Right. Well, the FCC program, I'm not an expert on the details, but I know they hold periodic competitive auctions, and it's based on the lowest cost to provide the service. And so in one of the recent auctions, SpaceX, which is launching its Starlink constellation, global satellite coverage to bring high-speed internet to rural areas, including in underdeveloped countries. And they won a big chunk of the last auction. And that strikes me as probably being the most cost-effective way, rather than trying to lay fiber where there's maybe one house per square mile in rural areas. That is a recipe for spending tons of money and having not very much bang for the buck. Whereas I think the space-based satellite broadband is going to be the wave of the future. And if they can afford to charge people in developing countries where there's no even landlines or fiber, and it's worth their while to pay for broadband service, there, certainly rural Americans will be able to afford the satellite-based broadband as it comes online. And it's in beta testing now. There's several thousand people in rural areas in the United States, and it's getting rave reviews in the tech press for high, very high download capability, fast getting movies, game playing, and all this sort of stuff. And it does cost, I think, something like $400 for the receiving antenna, but the monthly cost is competitive with fiber, with what is being charged for fiber where they have it. And so I think this is going to be a winner.
Well, thanks, Bob. Actually, one question I want to get in here, Bob, coming from your comments, is you raised the issue of public-private partnerships, which you can sort of think of as partial privatization. The idea is to move some of the risks and the financing with user charges from the government to the private sector. And public-private partnerships have been used for highway projects such as the Beltway widening in Northern Virginia a decade ago. And my impression is these projects have worked very well. Now, what is your understanding on Capitol Hill, whether there is broad bipartisan support for expanding public-private partnerships? There's a lot in the Biden bill that I don't think any of us like. But is there a chance to get some better legislation for public-private partnerships?
There is a provision for expanding the private activity bonds, which have been critically important to all of the highway projects that have been financed for P3s. There are 17 highway projects, mostly express toll lanes, like in Northern Virginia, that have been financed mostly with the private activity bonds, which are tax-exempt revenue bonds. And that that's proven to be a very well used program, but it's all the federal government only allocated $15 billion that would be allowed under the tax code, and that's all spoken for. Most of them have been issued; the others have been allocated to projects that haven't quite done the financing yet. So we need, there's a bipartisan bill in Congress to double the $15 billion cap to $30. That's a start. There's no federal cap on the amount of tax-exempt muni bonds that governments can issue. So I would say we've proven that there's a need and the value for these for the P3s, public-private partnerships. Why do we need a federal cap at all? Just let whatever the market is willing to support, based on, you know, the bond rating agencies have a lot of oversight over this, and the majority of these projects have investment grade bond ratings, by the way.
I'll take a quick one here. Someone asked how much of the Biden proposals require union efforts or union wages. The answer to that is all of it. If you go back and read Biden's proposals from the campaign and his current infrastructure proposal, which is on the White House website, paragraph after paragraph, he says, you know, funding for private stuff like broadband or state stuff like highways or federal stuff. He wants labor union jobs tied to all of the federal dollars he sends out. In particular, he wants so-called project labor agreements tied to every project that gets any kind of federal money. Now, project labor agreements are these agreements where essentially they impose collective bargaining for the project, whether it's a highway expansion or a transit project. And companies would need to pay union wages and benefits, and also these project labor agreements would impose union work rules on all these projects. I'm against this. I think that raises the cost of infrastructure so that the taxpayers sort of get less bang for their buck from these infrastructure projects. And, you know, remember that only 6% of workers in the U.S. private sector are in labor unions. So, you know, Biden's proposal would be very exclusionary. It would exclude most construction workers in the country because they're not members of labor unions, which I think is unfair.
Chris, can I just add a comment on this? In the growing literature, including projects by the New York Times and by various universities, looking at why is U.S. infrastructure construction so awfully expensive and out of scale with Europe, Japan, and other developed nations? And part of it is cumbersome work rules that are exemplified in the rebuilding of the New York or extending New York subways at three times the cost per mile of subways in Paris or Tokyo.
So let's, there's a question came in that's in Randall's wheelhouse. The question regards vehicle miles traveled charges. So, you know, that right now most money for highways at both the federal and state level are raised by gasoline taxes. But, you know, if we continue going in the direction of electric vehicles, obviously gas tax revenues will fall in the future. There's a lot of advocates for switching to a system of vehicle miles taxed, including, I think, Bob and Randall. So why don't you address that question, Randall? Can you give us a little more detail on how some of the pilot projects like in Oregon work with these VMT charges?
Well, one of the reasons I like vehicle mile fees is because potentially all owners of roads can piggyback on the fee system and use it to fund their own roads. Currently, state highways are funded out of gas taxes and vehicle registration fees, but city and county roads are mostly funded out of general funds. And oftentimes, cities and counties end up having to neglect their systems, and so they end up having the poor infrastructure because they're too busy building streetcars or other frivolous things than they are maintaining the infrastructure they've got. So vehicle mile fees can fix that. Oregon's vehicle mile fee system gives people a choice. You can just report your odometer readings to the state and then pay for that. The problem with that is then you don't know whether people are driving on city, county, or state, or federal, or private roads, and so there's no piggybacking options. The system I prefer and that I have is I put a GPS device in my car and it reports to a private company where I'm driving and when I'm driving. And the private company collects a fee from me and passes that money on to the state. The private company promises that they will not tell the state where or when I'm driving, but they will tell the state how much I owe the state or how much everybody owes the state who drives using this service. And so the state just gets a lump sum of money and they don't know who it's coming from or where it's coming from or where they're driving. Potentially, this will allow cities and counties to piggyback onto it. Private road owners can piggyback onto it. and it can even be used with variable prices in order to relieve congestion. I really like this system. I've been using it now for 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years, a long time, and it doesn't cost very much. I find it both convenient and I no longer pay gas taxes, so it works for me.
One of the incoming questions is, Mr. Poole, I believe your suggestions for expanding user fees are sound. What has prevented expansion in this direction under both Democrat and Republican regimes? I would I'd note on that issue, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently that said that the Biden administration is absolutely against using user charges for infrastructure because of redistribution concerns. They're concerned that user charges impact folks at the bottom, and they'd rather the burden of funding on people at the top of the income scales. I think this is a fundamental contradiction and problem within the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is for green solutions. They are for climate change solutions. Part of the climate change solution is moving to a system of more user charges. And so it seems to me the Democratic Party has these two different ideas that are really at loggerheads with each other. What do you think about that, Bob?
Well, I think you're right on that score, but I would hasten to add that the opposition to in Congress to pay as you go and users pay, users benefit is bipartisan. You have seen lockstep support. The gasoline tax, federal gasoline tax, has become in many voters' minds across the country just another tax because it no longer has the characteristics of the user fee. It's every time Congress meets, they decide to spend more of the highway trust fund on non-highway purposes. And whereas, as you mentioned, Chris, since the last time the federal fuel taxes were increased, which was 1993, just about every state has increased its gas tax at least once, and some have done it twice, because they have people trust what they're going to get. The increases are sold to people. Here's all the things we're going to do if this passes here, and we can't do them with the current revenue. And two-thirds or more of those referendums pass the voters. And so there's a huge difference in trust between the Congress of the public, between Congress versus state and local governments. And I think that's the underlying reason why at the federal level, user pays just seems to be dying.
I wanted to ask Bob a question to you about airports and air traffic control. I do find it fascinating that half of major European cities now have privatized their airports. Most airports in Britain, for example, are private. If you fly into London's Heathrow, that's a publicly traded corporation. And yet all America's 300 or 400, major airports, they're all government owned, which, this is remarkable, it seems to me, for a country that, yes. Believes itself as sort of a great economy of entrepreneurs. And yet we exclude entrepreneurs from the airport business. And you've also, Bob, written a lot about air traffic control. And I think it's fascinating that both Britain and Canada have moved their air traffic control to a private structure. In Canada, it's a nonprofit corporation. But we just don't seem to be able to go there. There's a lot of resistance. And why is that? Are American policymakers more socialistic than the policymakers in Europe, Bob?
There's a long tradition in airport funding of this being the need to have the airlines sign long-term agreements to support the bond issues in the 50s and 60s. Meant that the airlines got a lot, the incumbent airlines got a lot of control of airport finances and have not wanted to give it up. Now that's gradually changed as the major carriers that fly overseas now have a lot of experience using privatized airports. And they say it's not the end of the world. They get good service. And in fact, Chris, we have one US airport, San Juan International in Puerto Rico, that was privatized through a long-term public-private partnership, 40 years. This was about 10 years ago, and it has transformed that airport. The last time I was there was before the privatization happened. It was like something out of the 1960s, a generic hamburger thing, a generic newsstand, and that was about it in terms of the services. But it's now, both of my sisters and their husbands have been to it on vacation since then. And it's overnight dramatically improved. The management is a consortium of a private airport company that owns a lot of other airports. There's a whole industry out there that has developed of private airport management and investment. Latin America, go to Lima, Santiago, Chile. The major Brazilian airports are all now. Most of these have not done as Britain done and sell them to shareholders outright. They mostly have long-term, 30 to 50-year long-term public-private partnerships. But that gets you 90% of the benefits of an investor-owned company. And the companies themselves, many of them have 30, 40 airports that they are managing around the world and investing in. So it's been a sea change. I still have hope. Congress actually liberalized the former airport pilot program, and it's now available to all airports across the country, but it still has not really caught fire. Maybe in the recovery from the pandemic, this will become more popular. On the other hand, the Biden plan, if it dumps another $25 billion on airports, will take some of the wind out of the sails of the people trying to sell them on a public-private partnership.
Randall, a question for you. You're one of the most prominent experts on urban transit. Of course, the pandemic hammered urban transit. People don't want to go on subway systems in D.C. and New York because of worries about COVID-19. But even before the COVID-19, as you've documented often, urban mass transit ridership was falling. So, what do you think the long term effect of the pandemic will be? It seems that airline usage will recover fully, it would seem, in the longer run. But what do you think about mass transit? Will it ever recover from the pandemic?
No, I don't think it will. Not just because people are afraid to ride transit because they're afraid of communicable diseases, but because the pandemic has had so many other effects. It's going to lead to a much larger number of people working at home, at least some part-time. Is going to lead people to, say, move away from city centers. They're going to move to more suburban areas and smaller towns. It's going to lead to jobs moving out of downtown areas. Basically, transit is about downtown. There's a 90% correlation between transit ridership in urban areas and the number of downtown jobs. Most transit systems are hub and spoke systems that lead into downtown. So as people move away from downtown, as jobs move away from downtown, transit's going to lose. I don't think transit's ever going to get back to 75% of what it was before the pandemic. Now, a lot of people argued before the pandemic that transit relieved congestion, that transit benefited people who weren't using it because it produced all these side benefits, congestion relief, and energy savings and things like that. And it turns out none of those things were true. Transit is essential for congestion relief in New York City and maybe for a few downtowns like Chicago and Boston. But most cities in America, transit could disappear tomorrow and nobody would notice. And it could have disappeared in the middle of 2019 and no more than 1 or 2% of the people would notice because hardly anybody was riding it. Transit is based on a early 20th century business model. And Biden's plan really is a plan for the 20s. It's a plan for the 1920s, not for the 2020s.
Okay, thanks, Randall. And the last question here, we'll go to Bob. And the question regards autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. And Bob, I mentioned your excellent book on America's highways. A couple years ago, does the Biden plan address autonomous vehicles? And what do you think the federal government ought to be doing on autonomous vehicles?
I do not see any funding specifically earmarked for autonomous vehicles. We have the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which has the portfolio to try to develop whatever policy should federal government should be. And there are definitely safety potential, big safety improvement potentials, but also there's a lot of concern about how soon the AI, the artificial intelligence systems, will be even as good as a human driver at anticipating all different kinds of situations and reacting to them in time. And so there is a legitimate role for applying the same kind of safety scrutiny that's applied to conventional vehicles to autonomous vehicles. Now, this vehicle safety is shared between the federal and state governments. Federal government has the production standards and requirements and crash testing. States have licensing and you have to have your operational headlights and taillights and all these kinds of things. So I think that same division of responsibility should continue for the future of autonomous vehicles. But we're a long way from the dream of full robo-taxis that can go anywhere, and cars that can drive on dirt roads and snowstorms and so forth the way you can in your conventional car.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob and Randall. That's all the questions we're going to take today. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Cato posts our forums a day or two later on our website. So if you want to go back and look at what we've said here and send it to your friends, you can do that. Thank you very much for tuning in.